I didn't hear about To the White Sea until Intolerable Cruelty and Lady Killers had come out. And I think there was like an Ain't It Cool News article that was, I think, very speculative about how the script was out there and it didn't have any dialogue and it was like super expensive. And I think I thought it was about Hiroshima for some reason. And then there was like speculation about like Joel taking a back seat and like stuff about like 9/11. And it was just sort of shrouded in mystery. But I didn't think about it very much. And I didn't know that the script was actually available to read. I think until recently, until we started talking about the show. Or no, actually, it was a little bit before that, because I remember I downloaded that script and started reading it. I read like a quarter of a page. And then I was actually starting writing a screenplay. And it said, title burns in. And I feel like in my screenplay, there's title burns in, like, all over it. Like, the entire movie, I'm always saying title burns in. So in that sense, it was a huge, huge influence on my work.
I have read the script. Jordan has not read the script. That was an early decision. Those are kind of the basis of our characters mm-hmm. for the show. I've read the script. Well, I tried to read it and couldn't get very far in a very similar experience to what you described.
How many pages did you get into it?
I think I probably got like 2 pages in before I did some kind of off ramp and I just could not get any further. And then I read it straight through one night and I had a kind of wild experience. Normally what we'd be doing, we're going to read this script, which is 89 pages.
It's so short.
It's a perfect length for a screenplay.
That's a tight screenplay.
We're going to go through this script strictly 2 pages at a time. When we get to the end of a 2-page, wherever the page ends, that's
hard
where we
stop.
Hard stop. And then we are going to discuss what just happened. And then one of us will have prepared kind of a frame of, you know, how those 2 pages can kind of prismatically shine outwards into the rest of the Coen Brothers films. So to begin with, I just want to start this week and go through in real time through some articles that I've pulled, because I was following this in the trades as a teenager, and this is how it all came down, basically. Mm-hmm. August 15th, 2000. This is...
The newspaper spins.
IGN.
IGN newspaper spins into frame.
Brad Pitt to take a swim in Coen Brothers' White Sea. Brad Pitt has just added a new project to his already full slate of films, To the White Sea, to be made by Joel and Ethan Coen and based on a novel by the late James Dickey. The novel tells the story of a U.S. aviator near the end of World War II who's shot down over Japan and finds himself on a violent journey to get home alive. With its themes of survival, masculinity, and the extremes of human behavior, the novel is a sort of companion piece to Dickey's first novel, Deliverance. The Coens' next film is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? While Pitt has Guy Ritchie's Snatch and the remake of Ocean's 11 next on his plate.
That's interesting.
Variety states that Pitt will likely do White Sea next year after wrapping Warner Brothers' Ocean's 11. Okay, so this is in Variety.
Variety newspaper spins in a frame.
Fox, Coen sail White Sea. It says basically Fox is in final negotiations to handle domestic distribution. Production on the largely dialogue-free war drama, budgeted at about $50 million, is slated to begin January 14th. So it was going to start shooting January 14th.
2001.
2002.
Oh, 2002.
Yeah. What I'm getting from this Variety article is that, and maybe this is a good way of talking about the show in general, there's no book about To the White Sea. There's no chapter.
There's no Wikipedia entry.
There's no
Wikipedia entry.
I have bought so many Coen Brothers books, both on... like from used bookstores, they're stacked up on the table here and my phone is filled up with digital copies of them, but there's no chapter in any of these books about what happened here. This is like a relic that we're going to unearth. But in my experience, when I found a way past page 3 inside this relic, everything was alive inside of it and it was wonderful to exist within it. So we have to pull everything together from context clues and we have to kind of make, originally the picture is going to be a little fuzzy, but we're going to figure out what happened And I think we can start to just figure out right now what the questions that we're going to answer. I think the big question, the big mystery is, first off, why didn't this movie get made, right? I think we can answer that in this episode, just first off. Yeah.
Hmm.
And then I think a bigger question that will take the whole course of the show to answer is, what is To the White Sea? Like, I think that we can only answer that two pages at a time, walking through it and really bringing our friends in to imagine the film that would have been. The screenplay is so packed with so many different events and so many different ideas, so many images. I've read it twice now, and it's hard for me to contain it all in my head, and I want to share containing this in the imaginations of me and my friends and whoever wants to listen to this.
Well, I'm excited to hear it.
I appreciate that.
I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, and did I say it already that I haven't read it and you have?
Jordan hasn't read the script. I've read it twice. You know some stuff about the script. What do you? Can you just tell me right now, before I go further into the history, what you currently know?
To the White Sea is a novel and a screenplay about a guy in the U.S. military in the 40s, stranded in Japan, and he's trying to make his way back home. That's basically all I know.
Rad. I think that's a great place to start. From the earliest moment that they were announcing this film in the trades, they were forefronting the fact that it was a dialogue-free movie and trying to explain why they're making such an expensive film starring such a big movie star and no one's going to talk. It also says, with C, that Brad Pitt's dance card is filled for the foreseeable future, because this fall, he's going to begin production on Darren Aronofsky's untitled sci-fi thriller for Warner Brothers.
The Fountain.
The Fountain. In January, he's going to take a break from filming The Fountain. He's going to go to Japan and film the entirety of To the White Sea with the Coen brothers. And then upon completion of To the White Sea, he's going to return and shoot the rest of The Fountain. This is the plan.
Sounds like there might be some issues with that plan.
This is from ABC News. Brad Pitt hopes to continue scuffing up his glossy sheen with a new role in Joel and Ethan Coen's World War II drama. That's everything that's in that I could find pre the film falling apart. This is the next thing that I found. This is from 2007. It's an interview with Cormac McCarthy.
So there were no announcements about it getting canceled?
Not that I could find.
In the public record. Interesting. Yeah.
Cormac McCarthy asks him, what would you guys like to do that's just too outrageous and you don't think you'll ever get to do it? Joel says, well, I don't know about outrageous, but there's a movie we tried to make that was another adaptation. It was a novel that James Dickey wrote called To the White Sea. It was about a tail gunner in a B-29 shot down over Tokyo. So the guy's in Tokyo during the firebombing, but the story isn't really about that. At this point, it's kind of like spoilers. I don't want to get into it. They say some stuff, but...
Do they explain why it fell through?
It was interesting. We tried to make that, but no one was interested in financing this expensive movie about the firebombing of Tokyo in which there's no dialogue. I feel like that's the answer to the question, why didn't To the White Sea get made?
But they came really close. Like, obviously, funding was secured. Seems like there might be a more specific story there.
Interesting.
About someone, I mean, because you don't make all those announcements if you don't have... a backer, right?
Because he's saying no one wanted to do
it. Yeah, and that's not really what happened.
He's saying, you're saying that people said they wanted to do it, but when it came time to ultimately starting to wire the funds to Japan, they said no.
Well, maybe Ain't It Cool News had something going with the 9/11 theory. Maybe 9/11 put the kibosh. Just a guess.
Here's what Ethan says. Brad Pitt wanted to do it, and he has this sort of remorse or regret about it, but he's too old now. And then Joel says, you know, but there is something about it. There was echoes of it in No Country for Old Men that were quite interesting for us, because it was this idea of the physical work that somebody does that helps reveal who they are and is a part of the fiber of the story. Because you only saw this person in this movie making things and doing things in order to survive and make this journey. And the fact that you were thrown back on that as opposed to any dialogue was interesting to us. Here's another reason why I'm so interested to talk about this movie in depth, is I think it's completely visionary and ahead of its time in terms of it's from 98, so it predates Castaway, it predates Children of Men, it predates The Revenant or 1917, it predates the opening of There Will Be Blood, all those movies where you're just kind of following a character as they're doing physical activities and you're following the causality of that stuff. Okay, so this is from 2011. Coen brothers say their adaptation of To the White Sea is probably not coming back.
Interesting. So it got put on ice.
Yeah, in 2007, they're saying, yeah, no one wants to make it. It seems like Brad Pitt's too old. At this point, they're saying, Ethan Coen says in 2011, I don't think anything will happen with it. I mean, we came just short of being able to get money for it, and we did come up short even with Brad Pitt basically doing it for free. When asked if there was anything they learned on that adaptation, Joel Coen replied, yeah, don't set a movie in Tokyo during the firebombing unless you have lots of money to pay for it. That was the lesson we took away from that. Okay, so then in 2015, Warner Brothers announces that this other producer, the rights to the project have gone on to another producing team.
It'd be crazy if this got made by someone else. Just a totally different take on the material.
Well, you know, there's a previous draft that exists. Do you know about this?
No.
There's a draft by David and Janet Peoples from right after the book came out from the early 90s.
I think I recognize those names. What have they done before?
Okay, so they wrote 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
They have drafts of Blade Runner that you can read. And they did a draft of The Prisoner, like an adaptation of The Prisoner, Sergeant Rock movie for Arnold Schwarzenegger and Joel Silver.
Can we find that script?
Yeah, I have those scripts.
You have the script? No, but do you have the To the White Sea?
Yeah,
absolutely. Draft? You have their draft?
Absolutely.
Wow.
I have not read that. I have read, and here's the other thing. I have not read the book yet. I've read parts of the book. And I do promise to do is as we go through the two pages at a time, I will keep pace in reading the book.
All right, I'm going to hold you to that promise.
Yeah, thank
you. While I do not read anything.
So that's the gradual, steps of the Coens sending signals that it's not happening.
Yeah.
And then
it's receding into the mist.
Right. But let's move over to RogerDeakins.com in 2017. Mr. Deakins, I found this interesting online column in which the writer fantasizes about the abandoned Coen brothers project To the White Sea. What a film this could have been. Deakins says, don't remind me of what that film could have been. But then, okay, also Brad Pitt going to 2019.
Is that all Deakins said, though?
No, I have more Deakins.
Okay, because I want to hear all the Deakins.
That's all he said in 2017.
Yes.
But now in 2019, Brad Pitt in the New York Times, when you're trying to figure out things in your career, you get a lot of advice. People are telling you that you should be doing this, and other people are telling you that you should be doing that. There was this defining film I never got to do, a Coen Brothers film called To the White Sea. We had an opportunity to go, and then it was shut down. Then another opportunity arose, and instead I was talked into, no, you need to be doing this other thing. You can get to do your art project later. And I ended up taking that advice.
What movie do you think that was? Mr. and Mrs. Smith?
I don't know. We could probably figure that out. You want to put a pin in that?
Let's put a pin in it. Pin in. When?
I'm going to underline.
What? And why?
This other thing.
This other thing.
What was this other thing? 2020, back to RogerDeakins.com. What are the best screenplays you've ever read? This is the name of the... Is it a board? What is that? It's a post? A
forum post.
It's a forum post. The forum post is called, what are the best screenplays you've ever read? Are there any that stand out as being so good you felt you had to shoot the film just based off of reading the document? Deakins says, To the White Sea, written by Joel and Ethan Coen, is the best screenplay I have ever read and that never got made.
Wow.
So then a bunch of people are asking questions, and he says, we were in preliminary talks about how to shoot the film when Joel called me one morning to say it was not going to happen because of budgeting issues. That was a few days before 9/11.
Oh, so it wasn't 9/11.
Someone asks, were you going to shoot Anamorphic?
What? How did he respond?
Rashid Deakins says yes.
Yes.
We briefly talked about shooting Anamorphic, but it was early days. We had scouted in Japan, and we had talked about how to shoot the firebombing of Tokyo, which was a central event in the script and the most complicated sequence.
Did they say anything about whether it be shot color or black and white?
It's a good question.
I would assume it would be color, but I think the combination of the to the white sea, the color in the title, and just looking at screenplay pages maybe, and also but also more seriously, the way that the man who wasn't there looks.
Roger Deakins says there were other scripts written from James Dickey's novel, and a film is still a possibility. This is in 2020. The problem was, and still will be, the budget. It would not be a cheap production, so it needs a quote-unquote bankable star to play the lead. Then someone posts a website, tothewhitesea.com,
mm-hmm.
which presents an image. It says, based on the novel by James Dickey, and just shows an out-of-focus person with a bloody knife in their hands. To which Roger Deakins replies, even as a joke, it's sad to see the project being presented as a slasher movie.
He's definitely emotionally involved. It's the one that got away.
This is an interview with Roger Deakins in 2021 promoting his book of photos.
Oh, yeah, and that's also in black and white, too. I think that was the other reason I always pictured it being in black and white.
He's talking about To the White Sea. He says, that was the biggest disappointment in my work life, not getting that film done. I would still love to see that film made and work on it.
Wow.
Okay, so that's the end of my my articles. To the White Sea, screenplay by Joel Cohen and Ethan Cohen, based on the novel by James Dickey, August 13, 1998.
That's the cover page. It doesn't count towards the 2-page limit.
Absolutely. Fade in, cobalt blue. A dark speck is just visible in the center of the screen. It resolves itself into a seabird, flying toward us. As it passes, we hear the propeller engines of a B-29, and a title burns in. Tinian Island, March 8, 1945. From just below us, the aircraft looms into frame and roars off into the distance, leaving only the sound of the wind.
Fire. We're gonna bring it to him.
Close, on the weathered face of the colonel. Extremely close. He is the speaker. We are pulling back slowly at the cut.
Fire! This is what you've got to look forward to. That's what he's got to look forward to. We're going to bring it to him. To the enemy, you know? Up yonder, friends? Up yonder to the north?
He points his finger up.
North and fire!
Floating, high, high up in an empty airplane hangar, down below us, laid out like a grid on a bombing plan, are rows of folding chairs. In the chairs are khaki-clad airmen. Standing at the front is the colonel, just lowering his hand.
We are going to put him in it. That's saying, friends, that we're going to put it all around him. All around him. We're going to put it over him and underneath him. We're going to put it down on him and onto him.
Dissolve to overhead track. Closer, looking straight down on the seated rows of airmen passing beneath.
We're going to put it in his eyes and up his asshole, in his wife's twat, and in his baby's diaper. We're going to put it in his pockets where he can't get rid of it. White phosphorus. That will hold on.
Dissolve to forward track. From the back of the hangar, tracking forward, just skimming the heads of the airmen as we approach the distant colonel.
We're gonna put it in his dreams. Whatever heaven he's hoping for, we're fixing to make a hell out of it. Soon, good buddies. We just got the good word this morning. White, phosphorus, and napalm. That's our good stuff for the little and his folks. We're going to make him a present of it in his main city. Bestow it. Give it away with 300 airplanes. With both hands. They are going to remember us. Within a week, I clue you, That's all I can tell you now. But we're going all the way with incendiaries.
We have arrived at the colonel and come to rest on the extreme close-up with which we began.
No ammo, no gunners, all bombs, all payload, all fire.
Wide reverse. On the rows and rows of assembled airmen, staring mutely at the colonel, he continues.
The firebomb strike is going to be gravy. But that's not tonight. Tonight, it's the same as always. Gunners and all. One more time with frags. 2,000-pound GPs. We rendezvous at Angels 9 at 16:37. Your course is 3, 5, 6 degrees true. The target is Tokyo.
To the White Sea. To the White Sea. Of all the things I'd like to see, to the White Sea is the one I cannot.
So that's the first time you've heard those pages.
Yeah.
So I'm very, very curious to hear.
It's eviscerating. You can really imagine how it would play. I mean, it's almost too horrifying to imagine someone like so gleefully and like florally like putting this speech together to inspire his men to do this act of atrocity. Yeah, no, I mean, it's really rough stuff. Have they ever done a war movie? They've talked about war almost similar to how they've talked about like the frontier in a lot of their movies. And then they've actually gone to the frontier in True Grit. Have they actually done any scenes in like a military conflict? I'm trying to think.
I'm thinking about the submarine in Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about all the stuff with Langley in Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
Is that the closest that you get to it?
Best I can tell, yeah.
Yeah, perhaps.
Which are both like very different, but they're also like similarly like on the periphery and like underwater. And in a way that, you know, they did their big Western with True Grit, and it was the hardest movie. They say it was the hardest movie they ever made, but they never made their war movie. And that's what this movie is. So that's sort of my big realization. As much as I knew that that's what this was, my reaction to it is just kind of understanding viscerally that like this would have been like their entry in like revisionist war movie making. What year was Saving Private Ryan?
I believe it's 97 or 98.
97, 98.
Yeah.
And there was Schindler's List also from Spielberg. And The Pianist was like right around this time this was written.
Because Saving Private Ryan and Thin Red Line came out the same year.
Yeah. Saving Private Ryan is so influential on cinematography in general, just sort of the like halated, like desaturated look. That and also Three Kings, which is like probably a little bit off topic of what we're talking about. But just in general, like there was like a pre-Iraq War II kind of flourishing of war cinema that was like very, well, I guess Spielberg's was kind of nostalgic and very like morally opinionated, having a really specific point of view, which in some sense is like, you know, I think people get on his case, but also the fact that he's made films that have a very specific point of view is, and like a sort of a moral case, is definitely like one of the things that just distinguishes him as a filmmaker. And clearly the Coens are very interested in, I mean, not interested, influenced by Spielberg in one sense or another. What do you think this movie would have been like when you think about this movie?
You know, the mission in Saving Private Ryan that they're on, it's a sentimental mission. It's to protect this one guy.
Because his mom's lost all the other kids in the family, is that right? Yeah.
And then in Thin Red Line, I think about Jim Caviezel's character, who's basically just trying to stay AWOL and kind of is like a pacifist. Like a pacifist in World War II. And I think of this character as like a completely different character, and one that, like, in the same way that like the Jim Caviezel character is Terrence Malick's projection of his imagination and Spielberg has his projection, the Coens have found in this Dickie character and have even enhanced him to represent something totally different.
And it's basically just nihilism.
I don't think that's true.
No.
That's kind of what I'm not clear. It's an enigmatic screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's the most interesting is that the entire screenplay exists from the outside, but when you read the book, it's all interior monologue. And it's the same character in the book that it is in the movie. It's not really like they turned him into a different person. So there's these moments when you're reading the script, when we get to the part where it's like, what is actually going on in this guy's head in this scene? We can switch over to the novel and get an interior monologue of mm-hmm. what he's trying to do, what he's thinking. From the parts where I've peeked under the surface a little bit, things that appeared to me to be nihilism when I first read it were not that. But there is a statement here that I would like help figuring out, honestly. Do you want to just break down what happened in these two pages? Because that's the thing, too. I think it's one of the densest, hardest to read scripts I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's worth just being like, what happened here? So basically, what is being established in these two pages, you know, they're on a base. They're getting ready to launch these attacks on Tokyo. What he's describing is a firebombing. You know, it's just like a merciless firebombing where, you know, there's no targets. Yeah, your visceral reaction to it is he's just describing hell, creating hell on Earth for enormous amounts of civilians, and has nothing to do with like a back and forth of like one side versus the other. It's a giant military machine dropping a inferno on a civilian populace is what's being described. But that's not tonight. Tonight, we're going out the way that we usually do, where we have guns and they have guns and we have some smaller bombs and we're going to pick individual targets and we're going to attack them.
Do you think that the Coens were trying to, with this scene, they would be wanting to put you in the headspace of the airmen watching this speech? Like, where do you think the audience would have found themselves? Because so typically you see a character and they say something, or they give us give us an opening monologue. I mean, I guess classic screenwriting would say that the audience identifies with that character. In this case, we don't. In these two pages, we don't have really a point of view character. And in fact, this description of the scene is kind of like from the sort of perspective of God, right? Or like some overhead omniscient POV, intercut with close-ups of this guy.
The opening imagery, the opening poetic imagery, is so similar to the opening of The Tragedy of Macbeth, combined with the opening of Angelina Jolie's Unbroken. It early on establishes poetry first. And whenever I hear them describe this movie, they always say it's an adaptation of a book by a poet, James Dickey. The first foot forward is striking imagery, striking natural imagery. And then this, you know, this guy's making this speech, but the way they're describing the camera is so far, it's either very, very far away from him or slowly getting super, super close to him, where he almost becomes like this giant landscape, like his face, imagine like a Dr. Strangelove type, you know, close up of like a big craggy guy's face. I think that's kind of where you are in this opening. You start off with this bird, you start off with this landscape. This man is clearly, he's not saying it to us so much. He's saying it to this group of people that are all lined up in these perfect geometrical formations.
Another movie that starts similarly is Fargo, which also starts in like a white void.
Yeah, white void films. Fargo, Tragedy of Macbeth, To the White Sea. Do you want to branch out to the to the openings that we watched? Do you feel like we're done with the recapping what's in the scene right now?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, cool. So this week I read the two pages. Next week Jordan's going to read the following two pages. So since I read the two pages, I've presented the kind of frame that we're going to use to branch further out into the Coens films. So the frame that I chose this week, because the two pages that we read were dominated by this cold open monologue, is cold open monologues in Coen Brothers films. And so I basically went through and just said, this is the strand that I want to pull out this week and that I want to talk about. And when I did that, I got this list of scenes that kind of took you from the very beginning to the very end of their career. And I found that, like, we just watch all the clips stacked together back to back in chronological order. And when it looped, I felt like there was a connection between the Buster Scruggs opening monologue and the opening monologue of Blood Simple.
What was the similarity between Buster Scruggs monologue and the Blood Simple monologue?
Well, let's take them out. I mean, it's basically just like people, you know, it's an old cowboy telling you, like, people say that life is like this, but it's not, you know. It's about half of their movies start this way. When I actually went through, watched all the openings and pulled them out, the first one is Blood Simple. The last one is Buster Scruggs. Basically, what I want to do, you and me just watched all these back to back before we started recording. I have all the screenplays here. I want to think about the two pages that we just read from To the White Sea, and I want to look at the structure of these opening monologues and how they function, the experience that you have as an audience member meeting the worlds of these movies through these opening monologues.
Being framed, kind of. Like, the narratives are being framed by these extended bits of dialogue.
It has to be, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is the stuff, and this is what I want to do in the show. I don't have the answer, but I can see that this is a prism.
Yeah. And so this first scene we read, we were foisted into the world of that movie through this colonel's directives to his men to go lay waste to Tokyo, which is set up to horrify the audience. Do you think that there's aspects of that in any of the other opening monologues?
For sure. Absolutely.
Let's do Blood Simple, because I think that one is also...
Yeah, let's just start.
It's, to some degree, it's apropos, and also it's the first one.
So something that I just want to watch for in general is the types of characters that are doing these voiceovers at the beginning of Coen Brothers films. Because I think what you said earlier about, like, opening monologue usually being a way to get you rooted in the protagonist, you know, of the story.
Yeah.
I don't think they come at it that directly.
And they're not always using a narrator character. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they're having someone speak who is not necessarily going to offer narration throughout the story.
Right. So for Blood Simple, it's the antagonist, right? It's similar to Buster Scruggs in that it's the satanic character is the one who's giving you your kind of, like, intro into this world. Immediately at the very, very, very front of their career, this discussion of, like, socialism in Russia versus what we have in America. It's similar to the conversations in Hail Caesar in the study group, but it's just right. They get halfway through the opening monologue and just, you know, start bringing up communism versus just, like, the barbarism of, you know, America.
Laissez-faire capitalism.
Exactly.
In Russia, they got it mapped out so that everyone pulls for everyone else. That's the theory, anyway. But what I know about is Texas. Down here, you're on your own.
What I know about is Texas.
Yeah.
That's what he says. So to some extent, these monologues are kind of offering a social context or a comment on society.
Well, see, I feel like they would fight against that so hard.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that is a little, the fact that I would even bring that up, that they seem to be, like, you know, they can't help putting, like, talking about Ronald Reagan or George Bush, or they argue so strongly that they're not, like, sitting down and thinking about society. I guess another question that I'd like to answer in this show in general is just understanding what the process is by which they put together the ideas that ended up in the movies, because that seems so closely connected to their critique of the way that people analyze their movies. When people try to analyze their films and try to find like a political reading of it, or a very, very like overt lockdown symbolic reading of it, it seems to be like nails on a chalkboard to the Coens. And the thing that they always keep coming back to is, that's not what we're thinking about when we're trying to figure out what the character should do and how the character should behave. Our way of thinking about it is just so totally different.
It's just about the story and the protagonist and the conflict that they're getting themselves into or trying to get out of.
Well, I would say here's another thing that I wanted to, this is another reason why I wanted to do the show. I don't really have an answer for that yet, but that is one of the big things that I'm interested in is finding like kind of concrete stories or examples of how they actually, if they're so adamant that everyone is thinking about their stuff wrong, I'd like to think about it the way that they're thinking about it a little bit and try to find ways to do that and lock that down to something tangible.
But if they don't want us to be saying that they're trying to tell us about society, why are they doing all this table setting with a bunch of highfalutin monologues about society?
Like, why are you bringing up Russia 45 yeah. seconds into your first feature film?
Yeah.
Which is ostensibly like an exploitation film, like with a sold to look like Evil Dead or Road Warrior.
They brought it on themselves, these interpretations.
Right.
Perhaps.
Well, who brought it on them if not themselves?
The fans, the misguided fans. Let's read, let's go to...
Now this one, I would argue that this one is actually about the closest that maybe the To the White Sea is a combination of this plus Llewyn Davis.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not what I would have expected.
Okay. So here's what I'm thinking. This is where it's not a character speaking to us. It's not like Tommy Lee Jones is like on some secret microphone talking to us in our imaginary minds. And so is Blood Simple. So is the Big Lebowski, Hudsucker Proxy. This is just we're eavesdropping. This is diegetic.
This is dialogue.
Right.
So it's an extended stream of dialogue.
Right.
To someone else.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get what he wants.
For sure.
And he's speaking about his code, his moral code.
That's the thing. I think it's a person speaking with a lot of authority and a lot of passion about what they're doing in this world and what they're expecting other people to do. And the turn that the audience makes, they make on their own when they decide to become disgusted with the character that's speaking. Like there's clear moments in the middle of this where you're supposed to reject their worldview. I would say with Miller's Crossing, it's just the fact that the guy, he begins just talking about ethics, and really his thing is,
it's getting so a businessman can't expect no return from a fixed fight. That's kind of the moment where the audience is like, okay, this is a joke.
Yeah.
There's some irony to what he's saying.
Right.
And so, what's the point? What's that turning point in the as you see it in the To the White Sea?
I think it's when he says we're gonna put it in his eyes and up his asshole.
Because it's just it's too intimate of an image for a colonel to use.
I just think if you didn't like the guy already just by the fact that he was an authority figure, that he was like connected with like a violent organization, I think, you know, even a person that's like, yeah, I love World War II, you know, that's the off-ramp for everyone, right? It's less subtle than Miller's Crossing, but I think that's the beat. It's someone pitching you, and then they say something that just is so like dissonant
this old man is a pervert.
Exactly.
Okay, so Miller's Crossing, Hudsucker. Is there any connection between To the White Sea and the way that Hudsucker's opening monologue functions? I don't really see it.
I don't know about that, but I know that there's a connection between... I don't know if I have a connection, actually, between... No, what was
well,
the...
How about the... Well, first of all, there's a strong sense of time, of, like, something's about to happen at this specific time.
I'll say this. the reaction when we watched Hudsucker together was so similar to the reaction I had by myself when I watched all these last night. It was the second that it started, I just kind of like sighed. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where you're just like, oh, this is so nice, you know? And it was just so enveloping and so inviting. And the film, I guess, the big thing that I'd say about watching all these together, like, what is the function? Why would you start a film this way? I think it really casts a spell. It really just, like, it almost hypnotizes, it's a way of really almost hypnotizing the audience and bringing them fully into the wavelength, you know, where they need to be to watch the rest of the film. Maybe it's just the imagery, the way the film starts with just seeing the city from afar and just kind of seeing how pretty it is and wanting to get closer to it. And then the next shot is you're actually getting close. You're moving in and moving in and moving in.
It kind of envelops you in this classic Hollywood cadence. Like, it feels like, it feels like you're watching. I mean, to me, it feels like I'm watching Batman Returns. You just feel like you're watching It's a Wonderful Life or something like that. Like, the way that it has shows the character at the depths of their story, at the sort of the bottom of their struggle.
Here's what I'd say. It's like To the White Sea, in that To the White Sea ends with like a cliffhanger setup of like really what the, I mean, and also you'll see later exactly this little dynamic that they're setting up, that like the firebombing is happening, but not tonight, is what the rest of the story kind of hinges on, or at least the beginning of it. So it does, in the same way that Hudsucker leaves you with him on the edge of a building, potentially about to jump off, this does kind of drop you into, and now you're here, we're bombing Tokyo tomorrow night, what's gonna happen next? Which, like, some of the other ones just are more enigmatic or more kind of thematic.
It's interesting how they did the time jump in Hudsucker, which is become pretty classic. I don't know if it was as classic when they did that movie. It's kind of cheap. It can be kind of cheap, though, when they start the movie in media res and then they back up.
Hudsucker is a very, like, I guess you're wondering how I got here kind of opening, for sure. Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that in Llewyn Davis, they do that, but they don't tell you that that's what they're doing. And that's kind of the whole, I guess it's a reveal at the end of the movie that you realize you've seen this before and that it's actually happening after the story, that the opening of the story happened. I've seen people come out of that movie and be like, he's trapped in a time loop. That's what that's the point of that sequence. Which I don't think is what the actual meaning of the ending of that movie is. But maybe, I don't know. I mean, there's definitely something weird going on with the way that you categorize the beginning, his performance, his musical performance, and his one line. If you've heard it before, but it never gets old, it's a folk song. You consider that plus his performance before it a cold opening monologue?
Yeah, I did, based off of the standards of nobody talks before him, and that's when that's like everything he says until someone else talks. Because I do think also that when we watched that sequence in the chain of all of them, it was striking in how much it was just like completely, I would say, cast a spell, is totally riveting,
mm-hmm.
but is all of a sudden the camera is just so kind of fluid and like emotional. Like, they're all different kinds of filmmaking in their movies up until that opening, but always so locked mm-hmm. down. And suddenly just this very woozy shot that's just all about this guy's face. We're going to have these cutaway shots to people in the audience. We're going to have this great sound design, really going to give you a sense of what's going on in this room, what it feels like to be in this room.
And they recorded it live, too.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. I know that was like a big thing for them, is that all the music in that film was recorded in those rooms on those sets. Which, in a kind of perhaps an esoteric sense, it like lends credence to your argument that it was an opening monologue because it was performed on set.
Right on.
I'll buy it. But so we did Blood Simple, Miller's Crossing.
We did Hudsucker. And then Hudsucker goes straight into, Hudsucker is so much like Lebowski.
Yeah. Well, I'd say the Blood Simple monologue is a lot like Lebowski because of the way he jumps around and he says, I don't care if you're the Pope of Rome, President of the United States, or even Man of the Year. Something can always go wrong. And in Lebowski, he says,
never seen London, never seen yeah. to France.
He says, of course, I can't say I've seen London, and I've never been to France, and I ain't never seen no queen in her damn undies, as the fella says. Which, I don't know, it's just a similar cadence, you know, where he's bouncing around. He's sort of bouncing around the map in a similar way. But what were you saying? You were saying Big Lebowski's similar to what? Big Lebowski's similar to
Hudsucker, and they're both like, it's a narrator who's like a small character, like a very much a type. It's the elevator repair guy, right? Or is the clock, what does he do?
The clockwork engineer.
Okay, so it's the clockwork engineer and then
The cowboy. He's actually credited, they say, a Western accented voice, Sam Elliott's, perhaps. That's interesting. How rarely does a movie call out the cast member in the script? That's a no-no. They do add the screenwriting equivalent of allegedly. They add the perhaps.
His whole take apparently when he was on set was, I have no understanding of why I'm here. I'm happy to be here. I don't understand why you want me in this movie.
Genre trappings. But yes, the similarities between those two, Hudsucker and Lebowski, is they introduce you to a character.
Yeah, and they also tell you what year it is. Mm. You know, both, I think, and also watching these, I've been just watching all these YouTube interviews with the Coens, and something that Joel is always talking about of like, it's exotic. You know, you want to have a once upon a time feeling. And one of the biggest ways to do that is just be very specific about what time it is. So you can see these are humans. They're involved in primal human struggles, but everything that they're doing is strange in some way. It's different than what the people in the audience are doing. So when Lebowski comes out, it's a period film, but it's a period film to like, what is it, like 7 years earlier? But that is a part of what they're setting up in this opening.
Yeah, I feel like when you see it now, it's less obvious like how recently, you know, 1992 felt to like to 1997.
Yeah.
Although this was definitely a very Clinton era movie.
Oh yeah. These are just like all just nothing but hobbies.
Yeah. It was just the height of like slacker culture. It also really reminds me of Long Goodbye. It starts out with Elliot Gould waking up. He wakes up at like 2 a.m. and his cat is meowing, and then he tries to give the cat food. He's out of cat food, so he makes it like some disgusting like eggs and I don't know what else he puts. Eggs and milk. I think he like scrambles it up and then maybe something else. And then the cat's not interested. So then he has to go to the grocery store. He goes to the grocery store and he's asking for a specific brand of cat food, Corey's cat food. He goes back to his apartment, and then the guy shows up who puts the plot in motion, which is similar, except Lebowski cuts to the chase and has the monologue telling us who he is. And he's getting the half and half for his white Russians instead of the cat food. He's feeding his own monkey.
You watch both sequences next to each other.
Yeah.
Just the movement.
Hudsucker and Lebowski.
Exactly. Moving over the landscape,
mm-hmm.
and eventually just honing in on your central character after getting introduced to the whole world and everything.
Oh, yeah. With these really luxurious dissolves. Yeah.
Exactly. And how funny it is then, the way that it moves in on him.
There's the music playing.
He's making this big decision, and then it cuts to the cashier looking at him.
You see George H.W. Bush, and he says, "This aggression will not stand on the TV." Does that count as the monologue being interrupted by dialogue?
I think, did I put one sentence after that? I ran the clip to the end of... Yeah. but you know, it's arguable. Okay, so the other thing that I tried to do, all of these, I think something worth looking at, all of these monologues also basically tee up a throw mm-hmm. to something else. The Miller's Crossing one tees up the, like, am I making myself clear?
Yeah.
As Mud. You know, the Hudsucker one throws to the big music swell.
Mm.
And yeah. the Lebowski one, I think, throws to the guys attacking him in his apartment.
Right.
Blood Simple has that, you know, throws to the title really hard. Like, they all both like function that way too.
What was the next monologue after Big Lebowski?
Well, after Big Lebowski, I think it goes straight to Man Who Wasn't There, right?
Oh, Man Who Wasn't There.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a very voiceover-driven movie. Maybe their most voiceover-driven movie?
Yeah.
A lot of sort of discursive voiceover stuff, which is, like, fantastic. I mean, it's gotten way up on my list of Coen's movies after having rewatched it recently.
That's one of the things I'm the most excited about with this show in general, is already just in getting prepped to do the first show. Several of these films have gone from my, like, oh, that one's not good, I don't really like that, to, okay, I really do like this quite
is,
a bit.
This is, I have to admit, this is a masterpiece.
Exactly, which is where I'd ultimately like to get with all of this. My things for Man Who Wasn't There is just, were they not just hired to do basically this for Bad Santa? It's so similar to the opening of Bad Santa.
I haven't rewatched Bad Santa, so I can't remember.
Yeah, I swear to God, it's just
they're such different characters, though.
I know they're different characters, but there's just something about it that's
he's working a job he doesn't love. I never considered myself a barber. I never considered myself a Santa.
Yeah, I worked in a barber shop, but I never considered myself a barber.
If I'd known I was going to have to put up with a bunch of screaming brats pissing on my lap for 30 days out of the year, I would have killed myself a long time ago.
Frank Raffo is... I've watched that movie a few times. I never realized that that's Francis McDormand's brother. Even though it makes a lot more sense why they'd be going to the wedding, and he's riding that pig, which is incredible. Another... Okay, so this monologue is actually also interrupted in the movie, but not in the script. Frank Raffo, the brother-in-law, talking about how there's trappers out west because there's a market for pelts. Which is just, it's interesting because of how much trappers figure into, like, the last story in Buster Scruggs. And just in general, the way that their movies are peppered with this frontiersman imagery.
The song that Lewin sings at the opening is so, like, it sounds like a hanging, he's singing about a hanging scene from Buster Scruggs, or, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, the other thing I was gonna reference was just, like, the Face Down in the Muck monologues from Lebowski, Walter Sobchak's. It's just again, it's they're referencing the, you know, sort of stereotypical veterans monologues of, you know, the horrors of war, with a comedic, obviously, with, like, a comedic cast over it. We've never seen the Coen's version of combat, of war.
I understand what you're saying. It's like there are songs and there are stories that characters are telling about the frontier in Coen Brothers films. And then there are Coen Brothers films where you can watch where you're actually living in that frontier that those characters are describing. There are some characters that are veterans that describe what the lived reality of combat is.
Yeah.
That exists in their films. But there's no film of theirs that takes place in combat.
Maybe that would be a good episode, would be going through their movies and thinking about all the times that war is mentioned.
It's a great
by
idea.
Characters.
Yeah, I think that's like a perfect thread to pull out. Walter's description of war, it connects with what is represented in To the White Sea.
Speaking of Man Who Wasn't There, to pull on that thread is James Gandolfini's dialogue about killing in World War II, or is it Korea? Got to go back and look at that. But yeah, he gets killed with a penknife that he, like, says he stole off of a Korean or Japanese guy in the war. And then later it gets described by Tony Shalhoub's character as like a woman's weapon. Like, they're using that as a piece of evidence against Frances McDormand's character for why she killed James Gandolfini. But it's actually, like, this kind of gruesome war souvenir that Gandolfini's character stole from someone that he killed. And he uses it to open the letter with the blackmail note.
I'm thinking also in Hail Caesar, the Lockheed Martin representative
who's
trying to poach Brolin, his description of the atomic bomb being somewhat similar to the White Sea, just the kind of, you know, the blood chilling description of.
And he shows him a picture of it too.
He shows him a picture. Yeah.
And he's like, don't you want to get in on this?
Exactly.
These movies are not serious. This is serious. This is the real deal.
So far, these have all been older, gruff. It's all been gruff. It's all been older, older guys. Man Who Wasn't There continues that trend and segues into No Country.
It has been all old men.
Exactly.
Was up until this point, was there any non-old men?
I think John Polito is actually our age.
Yeah, John Polito.
But he wore it special.
He's definitely, he's pretty haggard. So then next in the monologues.
No Country for Old Men.
Oh, yeah.
Man Who Wasn't There and No Country for Old Men fit together in terms of just like, it's a guy talking about his job and talking about other people that have had his job in different generations.
Yeah.
And he's extremely gruff.
But it's so much more lyrical. I mean, it's so much more, it's a lament. But it's not like, oh, my life sucks. It's like, I wake up every day and I fear the unknown. I fear the criminal element. And, oh, interestingly, too, is he references the kid he sent to the electric chair. And Man Who Wasn't There ends with Billy Bob Thornton, Ed Crane. Is it Ed Crane?
Yeah.
Bad Cohen's not giving me the first and last name in all caps and the age of the character. Breaking all the rules.
We read in that interview where they're talking to Cormac McCarthy, they said they found a similarity in this material that reminded them of To the White Sea.
Yeah.
And there really is, there's so much in how they approached the adaptation and making No Country for Old Men that seemed like a little bit of a chance to go back and settle the score from things that they weren't able to do on To the White Sea. And I would say also, that's another thing that I want to pay attention to over the course of the show is just all the different ripple effects that happened from To the White Sea not getting made and ways that different collaborators that were lined up prepping to make To the White Sea then went and
made other movies.
Exactly.
That have like remnants of some of that prep and some of that vibe.
I think it's so visible. It's been 24 years now of just different parts of this project, the way that it existed, especially in Deakins's mind, but then also stuff where it's like, there's stuff that Angelina Jolie asked for in Unbroken when she asked the Coens to write it that seems like, well, she clearly read To the White Sea. No, that's not true though, actually. I'm going to take that back.
You don't think she read it? Well,
we were just saying that he had just married Jennifer Aniston.
He had just married Jennifer. But, I mean, don't you think he probably, maybe Brad Pitt just had this.
Hey, you want to read this old script?
You want to read? Well, okay. But, okay. No, but look, arguably.
He's on the record for being torn up for years. He's bringing it up in 2019.
I think they read it together when they were first getting together. That's what I think.
I feel like especially the people that are on the record as being in pre-production for To the White Sea, you can draw lines to other, like Deakins. You look at a movie like 1917 where...
It's such a cinematography-driven movie.
Yes.
It's a movie with one... It's all one unbroken take or, you know, a few cuts to black or whatever, but it's a movie with a gimmick or a conceit, a formalistic exercise. And Deakins brings a lot of ideas to the table in that movie.
Yeah, it seemed like Deakins was almost a screenwriter on that, as if you, depending on how you consider a screenwriter.
Yeah. He was definitely a visual author of that story.
It seemed like they were design sequences around visions that he saw. It seemed like they could work that into the script if there was something that he really had in his mind.
I am obsessed with how I think I noticed this before I heard someone reference it. But then I heard someone say that he always wants to have the light source in the shot, in every single shot he does, or at least in every scene that he does. Like, he never wants to have unmotivated light in any scene. It's just really interesting to watch his movies with that in mind. You think about, like, The Fire in 1917, and it's, like, the most insane version of that. And he did it in Skyfall, too, actually, with the house on fire, too. It's like, most cinematographers are just about, let me make this beautiful shot, and I will light it beautifully. Or what I'm saying is that he's a person who is very, very invested in the concept of the audience being aware of light.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the coolest part of his website, aside from the boards in which you can just talk to him, is you can just actually look at his lighting plans. And the one that I remember made the biggest impact on me was that train scene in the Jesse James Brad Pitt movie.
Yeah.
And just seeing how minimalist it was, it was like seeing that the ingredients for a recipe was like there's only like three things in it. That it really was just, there's the train. I put the lights inside the train, but I put them at this specific angle. And then there's like, there's some atmosphere and that's what you're seeing in the shot. And then you look at the shot and you're like, oh, I'm actually just seeing that light coming from that place. And then the light ceasing to go any further. And then that's like the shape that's making the composition is really surprising to me.
It's like when you see a master sushi chef and you're like, I'm literally just watching someone make like two cuts in a piece of fish and put this one thing on it.
Right.
And it's like a unfathomably perfect object, but it's also just so simple, like how you the combination of elements.
Right. And you can look up the lighting plans for like they built like a whole multiple rooftops all next to each other in the Blade Runner 2049.
Oh yeah, I mean the scale of the stuff he does too is also
same thing though. Yeah. It's like there's two big things happening. There's like two big light sources and it's just kind of playing out. It's like it's not like a simulation of a light event. He's actually just creating like an event.
The ring lights that he built for Blade Runner 2049 are just like, it's just so interesting how he has a few sort of go-to rigs and one of them is just, it's just a ring with bare light bulbs. It's not a ring light in the sort of in the way that we think of a ring light, which is like a ring around the camera. It's just a ring of lights that creates diffusion, but also puts a lot of light into the room because it's bare light bulbs all getting combined into, it's like a diffused light source just because of the number of lights. It's like if you lit a scene with Christmas lights, it would feel like a soft light source, even though it's not, because it's just a lot of little light sources. But anyway, for Blade Runner, I know that he did like just really, really, really intense. It's like a hexagon or an octagon shape, and it's like three layers of lights. So it's like he took this like kind of DIY self-taught lighting rig and just expanded it out beyond belief. So after No Country, up next, it's True Grit.
I love True Grit.
I do love True Grit now. Yeah. I only recently have I realized.
I love this opening. I love the use of the snow, the way that the snow makes that opening kind of apparition just seem to be breathing and seething. But then also the way that the snow looks in the shot that's very blue when Brolin is riding away is just incredible. It's like, because it the snow looks dark. It's like silhouetted and just looks like this, like it looks like ash from a volcano or something falling. It's incredible. The way that this opening image is basically just this character, it's like her projected imagination of how her father died and just how desperate and lonely his death was, and the way that Brolin's character just kind of rushes through in the foreground of that opening shot. In that YouTube video of them being interviewed in Israel that we both watched, I feel like this was maybe my end to liking this movie, honestly, was they said that it had just made Serious Man, which was their kind of exploration of the kind of Jewish psyche, right? And so they wanted to, they found the True Grit was like an excellent follow-up because it was an exploration of the Protestant psyche. And that this main character was just hilariously Protestant in her worldview. And that they really wanted to make a film taking that worldview at its face and then making a film where the physics of that worldview were represented in the film. So True Grit is an entirely Protestant movie where everything that happens in the film is like a Protestant morality play that plays out according to this main character's worldview. And this opening sequence puts us literally like inside her imagination of how her father died, the way Brolin behaved, which is very different than the way he is when we eventually meet him.
I think something we're going to talk about is ways that they have intentionally or somewhat consciously pivoted from one movie to another. After they made Blood Simple, their next movie was very much trying to show a different side of themselves as filmmakers or as a voice. Blood Simple is, I mean, Blood Simple has comedy in it, but it's very, but it's very, it's overall, it's a not Ella. It's not a movie with like a really foregrounded sense of humor. And then Raising Arizona is just incredibly wacky.
I completely understand what you're saying. One of the biggest pivots that they did like that is after True Grit, they're suddenly operating in this, like, it's referred to in these articles as their first four quadrant film. And it's, they say they're basically doing it tongue in cheek as kind of like, well, this is just like a story about people that believe in like an eye for an eye. And like that there's like, so it's an entire film about someone who's set on vengeance and says that nothing comes for free. And even the act of like taking vengeance, like means that she loses her arm. And that was incredibly popular because that them operating in that kind of a mindset suddenly put them in four quadrant territory, like firmly. When you heard, okay, they're making a film about like a folk singer and it kind of sounds like similar to Bob Dylan, like that's all stuff that's very popular. And so there was like maybe an anticipation that Llewyn Davis was going to be like a very different kind of movie than it was.
And also how it tied into Oh Brother.
Yeah.
In terms of like the roots music that they were referencing and the connection between
exactly
that music and T-Bone Burnett being involved. And then the movie they actually made was, I love it, but it's like a very depressing movie.
Right, because you could imagine a version of that film where it was funny as Hail Caesar, or just something where it's like, hey, it's all these characters, there's lots of like opportunities for like subplots.
Oh, I just thought of another glancing reference to the military is the guy in Llewyn Davis who's a singer, but he's like has to get back to the barracks or get back to the base. He gets his uniform on and he walks down the street. You see him walking. So tell me about this this so-called opening monologue in Llewyn Davis.
In Llewyn Davis?
Yeah.
Well, this is very similar to the White Sea because it's a person on a stage addressing a silent room of people. And we're just listening.
Went up on the mountain. There I made my stand. Went up on the mountain, there I made my stand. A rifle on my shoulder and a dagger in my hand. Poor boy, been all around this world.
I would say similarly, I have the lyrics to the song printed out here. I can look at them. Kind of the hinge of this song is the part where he's talking about going up on the mountain and making a stand, right?
Mm.
Like, I feel like that's what you're going to see for the rest of the film is him just struggling, basically even like almost against the elements to just like not stop being who he wants to be or who he once wanted to be. And it's doomed, you know, it's very much like, I don't know. It totally introduces you to the entire film
So at the end of the movie, you see that scene again.
Yeah.
But he's doing the song that he used to do with his partner. And then Nick says, doesn't he say something like, you and Mikey used to do that song, right? Or does he do Hang Me, Oh, Hang Me Again at the end of the movie? I can't remember.
I would imagine it's like the big hit song. What's the big hit song from the movie?
If I Had Wings. Yeah. Yeah.
He must sing that at the end, right?
Yeah.
Which is the song that they sang together.
Yeah.
That's the album that he's looking at in the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm. He puts it on.
Yeah. And so then I think that's it's interesting that that just then segues into Scruggs, which is also like a musical opening that then segues into a similar like character. I mean, it's funny the ways in the Scruggs is like a combination of all these different things together, mm-hmm. where it's kind of like
starts with a musical performance,
which is like completely resonant with the, I would say like the hinge of that song is don't you listen to him, Dan, he's a devil, not a man.
Yeah.
Which I feel is like, that was probably for you and me both like the key for us, like loving this. We're just like, oh, this is Satan. Like this Scruggs character is a combination of when the like returning Satan in the flesh, Cohen's characters, but he's also kind of like Sam Elliott in Lebowski.
Yeah.
And then his explanation of who he is kind of similar to the Miller's Crossing thing of him being like, look, I'm here. Let me tell you who I am, what I'm all about. And as he's talking, there's these, you know, the flaws in his story. You know, when he pulls out the poster calling him the misanthrope, you know,
yeah.
It's just like, well, he's clearly the devil. But then also it's just funny because there's so many, anytime they do a Q&A, people ask the Coens, like, do you hate humans and do you hate your characters? And there is just something very similar just in them being like, no. Like, there's something autobiographical about this Scruggs intro where he's like, no, I don't hate people. I just, you know, that's just the human material. And then it's like, bang, 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 bang. And it's like the Coens are just like smudging all these characters the same way that Scruggs is.
Yeah, that tracks.
Misanthrope? I don't hate my fellow man, even when he's tiresome and surly and tries to cheat at poker. I figure that's just the human material. And him it finds in it calls for anger and dismay is just a fool for expecting better. Ain't that right, Dan?
So my theory about all this stuff is that the function of an opening monologue like this is when you're going to make a film that's set at an extremely specific pitch, right?
Yeah.
One way that you can just do that is just say the audience is going to pay attention to the voice of one character for up to about 3 minutes. And we're going to throw a couple zigs and a couple zags at them. And they'll kind of learn the boundaries of at least this tone, this world. And they'll like fall under a little bit of a spell. They'll get hypnotized a bit to be able to enjoy the rest of the movie. And I feel like the Llewyn Davis, when you watch all the other sequences back to back, it's so obvious how much it's like, you're really going to have to like latch in on this guy to enjoy the rest of this movie is what they're telling you right at the beginning.
The interesting thing about him is that he is captivating the audience. He's a compelling performer, and then when the movie progresses, it almost feels like he's kind of a marginal figure.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that the movie sets him up with like a kind of heroic musical performance at the beginning to like set the audience in a certain mindset where they're like, okay, there's something here. But I think that it's important that in that sequence that like you have that reaction. There's one reaction shot of a woman who's like rapt. It's a movie about like someone who does have appreciation in their scene, in the folk scene. And I would just say like, if you cut that out and you just started the movie as is, you could just be like, this is about a like marginal figure struggling to make it, who's maybe not even that good. And I think what the movie's really about is that like, it's not just about talent. It's about like branding or like whether you're a four quadrant artist or whatever that means.
The opening makes you believe in what he believes in for himself. And so everything that happens after that hurts because you know that there's something there. You at least experienced it.
What's our next segment?
Okay, so there's two segments that I'd like to try out experimental on our first show. First one is called Poetry Corner. And so I'm going to read two poems by Ethan Cohen. And we can discuss them.
I love it.
Or do you want to read one?
I'll read it, yeah.
Okay. You can cold read it.
Give me that out of that three ring.
And I'll read the second one.
The day the world ends. The day the world ends, there will be the sound of a long whining fart, and everyone on the street will stop and look at each other as if to say, "What the hell is that?" Till the sound is cut short by a thunderclap, so loud that, ears ringing, people will stagger about as if drunk, hands clapped to heads, eyes slit, mouths O-shaped, and then the vibrating will start, but not last long because, poom, an outward blast will splinter the concrete and shoot everyone into the air like champagne corks, and the G's that suck at their bodies will tick down as they reach the apex, where for one moment they will float, looking gravely at each other, before starting back towards Earth, which, sad to say, shall no longer be there. And they will fall and fall and fall, with nothing to stop them, accelerating faster and faster, until they burst into shrieking flame. And then finally, and forever, their ashes will dither and swirl in the dusk of eternal nothingness. When this happens, and it will, don't be saying, oh, wait, can I have a second? Nobody warned me. Try it. They'll shake this poem in your face and say, remember this? Remember this, jack off? I think that pretty much speaks for itself.
I don't even think we need to do a second poem. I think we should save... We should save these for further episodes.
Yeah, let's save it for future poetry corners.
All right. So the second experimental segment I'd like to do is more like, I guess it's like a feat of strength oriented. Joel or Ethan is the game. Oh. Okay. And I'm just going to pick to a random page. And you tell me who is talking.
Okay. This is like trying to tell who wrote which Beatles song. Do the Coen brothers have other siblings?
It's a great question.
Is there Cohen's sister? We're going to look this up. We'll have the answer in the next episode.
Okay, here we go. People were terrified of that. Black and white stigmatizes a movie in the eyes of the exhibitors. It means it's an art film. They are leery of it. They may have good reasons. I don't know. However, it was important to us to make it black and white, though it was harder to get the financing. Is that Joel or Ethan?
I'm going to say... Joel.
It's Ethan.
It's Ethan?
Yeah.
All right. I'll pick one now. Your turn. The page is stuck together. You know, some of these interviews, they don't say who's talking. Have you noticed that? Have you wrestled with that?
I think we're wrestling with it currently.
Oh, we had a great time with Joel. We'd work with him again.
That's one of the Coen brothers speaking?
Mm-hmm.
And he's speaking in the context of he's quoting someone else.
No more hints.
So you're just picking one sentence, whereas I read you a complete paragraph. You're picking one sentence out of a paragraph.
We didn't know. It's a one sentence answer. And also we didn't establish any ground rules about this.
I would say that's Joel Cohen.
It is Joel Cohen. Speaking about Joel Silver.
Oh, no.
You are the weakest link. Goodbye.
You wanted to do another one?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try to give you one more fair.
That was mind-bending.
Why is that funny? Well, I'll tell you, in one respect, he's sort of an audience surrogate. He's the one character who's not local. Even Peter Stormare, his sidekick, is not of the region, but he's Swedish. So in that sense, he's connected to the region. So as a sort of alien in the landscape, he even dresses inappropriately for the climate. He's, again, an outsider, an audience surrogate in that respect. And, you know, there's just something sort of refreshingly chatty and direct about Steve, his character.
That's got to be Joel.
That's Ethan.
Really?
Yes.
I could just see him saying it. I mean, the underlying... We're driving to an underlying point here. Can you think of a fork in the road that one of them would approach and they would do something different than the other one? Do you have a sense of them as independent people?
Well, one of them married Frances McDormand. This one just has Coens as an answer. Do you think marijuana should be legalized? Coens. You mean it's not? Actually, the point of view is built into the character of the dude. It's in the core of the, yeah, it's about LA, man. All right, give me one more.
Okay. A dog movie. We haven't done that yet. Like Old Yeller.
I'm going to say that's Joel.
Correct.
Yeah. I don't know why. And that was To the White Sea, episode one.
Do you think so? Well, okay, let's just do you want to talk about the future? Or you'd like
call I would it? Just say tune in next week for To the White Sea, episode two, pages 3-4. Topic TBD. Because I'm going to have to be the presenter next week, and it's going to be a lot more not thought out. Until next time, keep it crispy. To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Michael Preston as the Colonel.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandaraja.
To the White Sea theme music, written and performed by Dan Romer.